So when there was a panel discussion about what the most important things that have been discovered about quantum gravity were, nobody mentioned holography, which I thought was an amazing oversight. But it's true, it's not actually a fact, it's just a conjecture. Well, there are lots of reasons. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about trying to understand why there would be a holographic entropy bound, some of my efforts trying to understand why there would be a holographic entropy bound within a semi-classical picture as a result of gravitational back reaction. Okay, so I'm going to talk about Busso's form of the holographic entropy bound. This is Busso formalized a bound that had been developed by a number of people. Bekenstein and Suskind had something very similar to Busso's bound in his paper. So now I'm going to explain, for those of you who don't have it fresh in memory, what this bound says. Okay? So the first thing is you have a null sheet, which is a hypersurface, which I will call NR, okay, swept out in space-time by future null and normal geodesics emerging from one side of a two-dimensional disk in space-like disk in space-time. So since I have trouble drawing four-dimensional pictures, I've just indicated this disk as a line, and here come the normal geodesics. I will call them generators. And these generators, in addition to, as a condition on these null sheets to be legitimate for our purposes, we also have to require that the generators are not diverging at S0. Either they come out parallel or they come out converging, but they're not diverging, okay? So, now, Busso's conjectured holographic entropy bound says that the entropy on this hypersurface is less than or equal to 1/4 the area of this two-dimensional disk here in Planck units. Okay? So the entropy, instead of being extensive in the volume in some sense of this three-dimensional region, is extensive only in the cross-sectional area. Okay, so the first thing you might ask when you see that is, what do you mean by the entropy on this null sheet? Now, obviously, it's easy to imagine what's the entropy on a space-like hypersurface. It's like the entropy at an instant of time. But this is a null hypersurface, so it has no domain of dependence, so it's a little bit odd. But, okay, so Busso spoke about the entropy of a matter field, only the entropy of matter, and he supposed that his matter field was in a state of local equilibrium, so he could define an entropy current vector, a four vector, and the entropy in this hypersurface was simply the flux through the hypersurface. Okay. But, more generally, one could accompany this NR with an NL, now you can understand why the R and the L, which is traced out by the geodesics, the normal null geodesics coming out the other side of S0. And similarly, I didn't say that before, you have to cut off these hypersurfaces before the generators cross or form a caustic. Okay, that's very important. Okay, and then this region, okay, this region would have a space-time region as a domain of dependence. Data on this double null sheet does determine the gravitational field or whatever fields in a relativistic theory in a certain space-time region. So you can talk about a phase space. There's a phase space. You can imagine that there would be a Hilbert space. And then the entropy would simply be the number or the phase space volume of microstates compatible with your macrostate. Okay? So in this case, if both of these are null sheets according to our definition before, then the entropy bound would be that the entropy on this double null sheet would simply be the area of this cross section here at the base, at the fold, or 1/2 the area in Planck units. Okay, so now, finally, there's, well, I don't know if it's a theorem, it's not a theorem, but it's something that's very usual in real systems, and that's that the highest entropy thermodynamic macrostate has not only more microstates than all the other macrostates, but it has essentially all of them. Okay, and that suggests so this hypothesis suggests that the dimensionality of the Hilbert space of the part of the subspace that corresponds to a given macrostate is less than or equal to the exponential of this area over 2. But if that's the case, that the highest entropy macrostate has essentially all microstates, then in fact the dimensionality of the whole Hilbert space of the fields and the gravitational field in this region should be less than the exponential of the 1/2 the area of this fold in Planck units. Okay, so you could ask, well, so that's what Busso says. Is it true? So Suskind, before Busso said this, in his version of this, already suggested that this is really a consequence of gravitational back reaction. Okay, so my main research project is trying to put this whole thing on a firm, rigorous footing. And you know, the idea, what seems to be the ideal framework for that is just to develop canonical general relativity and eventually other fields too on these double null sheets. So there are some publications. I have 2 students who have thesis on related to this, Rodrigo A. Gerarde and Andreas Fuchs. But this is really pretty technical. And so there's another thing though. As one develops this very technical stuff, you have to know what you're looking for. And so I thought a little bit, just a little bit, heuristically, about trying to improve or make a little bit more firm these arguments of Suskind about gravitational back reaction. So I'm just going to share a little bit of that with you. I'm not going to talk about this other stuff. Okay. So how can one understand the holographic entropy bound? Well, so first argument version 0, the simplest one. Suppose I have one of these null sheets, and I'm going to move the surface where I will suppose, for simplicity, that all the generators go to a single one-point caustic. It's just to make it simpler to draw, and I will move the truncating surface here right to where the caustic is. And I will suppose that n quanta of some scalar field crosses this null sheet. And now I decide that I want to stuff one more quantum through this null sheet. So I put this quantum in here. So what does that do? It makes the generators focus more, right? Because the matter on a null hypersurface makes the generators focus. And so they focus more, and so this last quantum here that was at the tip has fallen off the hypersurface. And so there's a mechanism that seems to maintain the number of quanta on the hypersurface at n. Of course, this is not a proof, but it's hardly needs to be said. But you know, so there's a mechanism. It doesn't seem totally absurd that you could somehow end up with a finite dimensional space of states. Okay, so if it's finite dimensional, you'd also want it the logarithm of the dimensionality of the Hilbert space to be extensive in the area. And so we can imagine taking 2 of these null sheets and gluing them together, one beside the other, suppose they're identical, and so there's a fact, a basic fact about these null hypersurfaces that the only points that are causally connected are the ones on the same generator. So all the points in this double null sheet are space-like to all the points on this double null sheet. Oh, any observables, therefore, on this double null sheet will commute with any observables there. So if the Hilbert space associated with one has dimension n, one would expect the Hilbert space for two of them to be just a product, and it would have dimension n squared. Okay? Robert, if he's here, will note that we're not in the hypothesis of the Riesz-Lieder theorem. I don't know if he's here. Okay. Okay, so that would mean that the dimensionality is extensive in area. Okay, so that was so here comes a slightly better argument. Okay, so the generators of one of these hypersurfaces, as the generators satisfy a convergence or Reichardt-Hurey equation. And it has a term involving the mass, but since we're going to do, involving the stress tensor, this is the component of the stress tensor along the generator. And, but we're doing semi-classical gravity, so we put here the expectation value. Also, we will ignore the effect of shear, which just makes the focusing stronger. Okay, so you can take this equation, and if you suppose, just to make things simple, because we're doing back of the envelope here, that this expectation value has a uniform value, tau, okay, just to make the calculation simple, you can solve this equation, and you find, I'm sorry, this theta is the expansion. I think everybody knows. Yeah, so. And you find that the generators all cross at a distance lambda max, a fine parameter lambda max that's given by this expression. Okay. So if we're going to cut off these hypersurfaces before these generators cross, then the cutoff, the affine parameter where they cut off, lambda bar, has to be less than lambda max. Okay, so now we, okay, so now suppose that we have a sinusoidal mode of a scalar field that lives on this hypersurface, and it's excited with one quantum, and then the component of the momentum along the generators is h bar k lambda. K lambda is the number of wavelengths times 2 pi divided by lambda bar. But the momentum can also be calculated in terms of the expectation value of a stress tensor. And this gives you a bound, it gives you a relationship. Okay, so this gives you a bound on tau in terms of lambda bar, and you can substitute in the requirement that lambda max is greater than lambda bar, and you get a condition that says that the number of wavelengths cannot be greater than the area of the cross section in Planck units divided by 32, okay? And if you have more particles and more modes, then you have this sort of limit, which makes it look like you have a finite dimensional Hilbert space. But actually, it doesn't yet, because you can have an infinity of modes with the same wave number in the direction of the generators. But then you apply the same reasoning to the other branch, NL, and you have to apply one more condition that says basically that the double null sheet is not of sub-Planckian dimensions, and then you do get that you have just a finite number of dimensional Hilbert space. Okay, so I'll just say what the conclusion is to this and not really explain anything. Okay, so that was still, so that was a bit better, but it was a bit here, but quite a bit heuristic still. So I thought, well, let's just try to do better with quantum field theory. So the idea is you quantize the initial data for a scalar field on this null hypersurface, which is just a scalar field itself restricted to the hypersurface. Then you can, from that, you can calculate the stress energy tensor, or you can hope to do that, that from that together with gravitational initial data. And that has to satisfy this focusing equation, which acts as a sort of constraint equation. So maybe, in fact, that only works out for a finite set of states, right, of the quantum field. So so the idea is that sort of constraint equation only can be solved for a finite number of states. That would seem to be like the field theory version of the argument I just made. Now, does that work? And well, no. In principle, not. You can construct a sort of a counterexample, right? A field quantization, which has, in fact, a whole infinite-dimensional Fock space of states where all of this is consistent with a focusing equation, and there's no caustic on the null hypersurface. But okay, jumping to the end of everything, but this field quantization is bad in a sense because there's a version of the positive energy condition in curved space-time called the microlocal spectral condition, and it violates this condition. I was going to say this in a much more interesting way, but yeah. Okay. Of course, so that leads to the idea that this positive energy condition is crucial to understand holography, the holographic bound. Okay, so I should also say that, of course, well, I didn't say the other stuff, so I don't need to say this. Okay, so that's it.
Say Hawking radiation has a negative violence, for instance. Would that mean that once you...
No, okay, so I had to, I just had to go right to the conclusion. So the microlocal spectral condition is a very specific sort of positive energy condition.
So the Unruh vacuum on the charge should make it satisfying?
Yeah. So it's a great triumph of curved space quantum field theory. I'm sure you're aware that about 15 years ago this condition was found, and since then curved space-time quantum field theory is more or less at the same status as flat space-time quantum theory in terms of development.
Here.
You
have questions?
Yeah, the expectation value of the energy tensor you have put before, is with respect to a particular state, or do you choose that state, or what?
Okay, so there are many quantizations, right? Mm-hmm. And the expectation value depends on the vacuum you use to construct the quantization. And in fact, yet again, in curved space quantum field theory, it's just precisely the microlocal spectral condition that guarantees that you can even define the expectation value of the stress tensor. But now that I've said so much, I should say also the other thing. Of course, we're not in curved space-time quantum field theory because that's on a fixed curved background. So here we're on a, for every state, we have a different curved background. So some sort of positive energy condition should be there, but it won't be exactly the same.
Questions? No, so let's thank Mike. Jacopo. And he's going to tell us about continuous limits. And so we are using his computer because he's got nice animations.
Just one.
Or one.
All right, thank you very much. I want to talk a little bit about the continual limit of graphs. And this is a work that I've been doing in collaboration with Iñaki Garay. So what's the motivation to do this? Obviously, we know that in quantum gravity, we're expecting a fundamental discretization of geometry. And in particular, in loop quantum gravity, we have spin networks, which describe or our states. So those are things that are based on graphs, right? But we want our quantum gravity theory to somehow explain how we get to the continuous picture, to the normal geometry that we experience. So one question that one could ask is, like, is there any relationship between a given graph and the geometry? Like, is there any geometrical information encoded in the graph itself, in the abstract structure of the graph? And this, in general, is a quite hard problem. But one could try to go to simple cases, and try to find out something. So there's a known work by Bombelli, Corici, and Winkler. And they propose to use Voronoi graphs and study their structure and see if that allows one to get some geometrical information from them. So what we want to ask here is, how well does it work, what they propose? This is basically what we wanted to do. So first thing is, what is a Voronoi diagram? And a Voronoi diagram is just something you construct with a set of seeds, and then basically you have a metric in your space and everything, and you just say, construct the regions of that space that are closer to one seed than to any other one. Basically, I have this little video that is quite graphic and tells us what a Voronoi graph would be. So we have all those seeds, and then they kind of claim the space that is closer to them. And then you end up with this kind of graph structure. So that would be a Voronoi graph for this set of seeds, right? You can do that in any dimension, two dimensions, for example. You end up with edges that are equidistant to two of the seeds, and then you have vertices which are equidistant to three seeds. You can do the same in three dimensions. And one property that I'm actually not going to use now, but of these Voronoi graphs is that their dual is always a triangulation, and it has a name. It's called the Delaunay triangulation. So what did they propose? They basically are pretty much restricted to the 2D case. And what they say is, let's sprinkle a random set of points on a given surface and then construct the corresponding Voronoi diagram. Now, that has a lot of geometrical information, of course, but we want to get rid of it. So we're going to just get the one-dimensional skeleton of that diagram. We're going to forget about the faces and just have the graph. And we also, yeah.
The dual is a term. I'm confused. The dual is a term relation.
Yes. And we actually also forget about the metric in the space. We just get the abstract structure of that Voronoi graph. And now we want to do the inverse problem and try to see if we can recover any information about the original surface we used to construct a Voronoi graph. To do that, the first step would be to reconstruct the faces of the thing that we had just gotten rid of. And what they propose a definition of Plaquette, which would be any closed loop that contains the sources path between any two vertices in the loop. So using that definition, one tries to reconstruct all the possible plaquettes, and one finds a lot more than the original one. So that is not enough. One also has to impose that we want to recover a surface, so we are in two dimensions. When you do that, basically that comes down to say that every edge has to be shared by two plaquettes or surfaces. With that second condition, one can go back to reconstructing the structure of the Voronoi diagram. And now we want to try to compute the curvature. And what they did was basically use some topological, we have the Euler number here, which is a number of vertices, edges, and faces. And there are also some relations between number of vertices and edges and faces coming from the fact that we know that all vertices are trivalent because we're having a random sprinkling of points, so that happens. And also this is the average number of edges by face. And we can also construct that as, well, total number of faces in the graph divided by number of faces. So using that one gets to this equation for the average in terms of the Euler number. And this is given through the Gauss-Bonnet theorem by an integral on the curvature. Now they say we can try to make the approximation that we're gonna be looking at a small region where we can consider curvature is constant. Then that comes out of the integral and we can just like substitute and find this equation for the curvature, which in basically goes in terms of the average number of sides per face. And it tells us that for average 6, we have a flat surface, and for average lower than 6, then we have positive curvature, or and so on. Now, how do you effectively apply that to a given graph to find things? Well, obviously, you have to find the optimal size for your region, and that has to find the balance between two things. You want a large enough region so that you have a good statistics there, you have large enough number of plaquettes that you're going to be looking at and averaging on. But also you don't want your region to go too large because then you're going to exit the region where you can consider curvature constant. You're going to start see curvature changing. And so, well, you can try to find the balance between that. And the procedure they suggest is just take an initial cell and then keep adding to your region neighbors, so different degree neighbors. So from that cell, you add all its neighbors, and then you take one extra step, and then you have one more layer of neighbor cells, and you keep doing that. And at every step, you can compute the standard deviation on the number of sides. So you will expect that that number is going to be decreasing as you increase the area, but at some point, you'll start raising again because you're exiting the constant curvature region. And at that point, you find the appropriate size for your region, and that's the value of the curvature you're measuring. So that's what they proposed, and we set out to test it. So simplest possible case, you just take a sphere. In that case, you don't even have to worry about going too large. The larger you get, the better, because you always have constant curvature. Let's see if we find something interesting. We construct Voronoi diagrams. We use standard algorithms to have, you know, enough computing power to do pretty big things and even more than 20,000 seats and stuff like that. But then we compute things and we see that so as we increase this is basically the number of steps, the number of layers we have added to a region. And this is the average number of sides per face. And it's higher than 6 all the way, and it tends to 6 or a little bit less than 6 just at the end. So when we compute the curvature with that, we find basically negative curvature all the way, except at the very end when basically our region covers the full sphere. So only when you take into account the whole sphere, then you're getting the right curvature. The rest makes no sense. But okay, this is just 1,000 seats. Let's get better statistics, see what happens. Get 5,000, get pretty much the same. You get 10,000, you keep getting the same. With the aggravating fact that it's only at the very end, like it doesn't cross to positive curvatures earlier like it did for 1,000 seats. It goes all the way till the end. So this is not working, all right? So yeah, we find that curvature does not stabilize to any value. It keeps changing. And even worse, it's negative for a sphere, except in the very end when you cover the whole sphere. And also, if we increase the number of points to improve the statistics, but we don't get any better. So there are two main questions, like, do the assumptions that we made to derive the equations really hold? Is there anything wrong with them? Are we maybe applying topological concepts to local computations and that doesn't make too much sense? Or, yeah, are we considering the right topology of the things we are actually doing? And the other question is this procedure for implementing and computing appropriate? So for the first question, actually, these regions that we are expanding are disks, are not the full sphere. So they have a different topology. And that also changes some of the relationships between the things. So if we consider a disk, we have internal edges and external edges. So that changes a little bit this relation. And also for the vertices, we have three kinds of vertices. Actually, we have the internal ones, which share three edges in the subgraph we're considering. But we also have these external ones that are on the boundary, but the third edge goes inside. And there are the outgoing ones that I've called here that are also on the boundary, but their third edge goes outside of the region. So they have different relationships between the numbers. So we can use this new set of equations to do the same thing. We get basically the same equation, but with an extra term here. That only determines, only depends on these vertices on the boundary, right? And if we now use the Gauss-Bonnet theorem, we also have an additional term, obviously, which is the boundary term. So we can rewrite the formulas, and we get these to this equation. Now, what we have here, though, is that if we compute this, what we're going to get is this Euler number. That's a constant for this. It's a 1, and it will always be a 1. The only way we can get the curvature out here is if we find a way to split the two terms here. We need to know how much of this thing corresponds to the boundary term and how much is the curvature. But if we look at that, I mean, it is pretty obvious that this term is the same we had before. It coincides with the bulk term in the case of a sphere, and it depends on the bulk variables. And this term only depends on the boundary, and it only appears when we have a boundary. So it's pretty obvious that this seems to be the bulk term and this seems to be the boundary term. But if we do that, we're just stuck with the same formula we had before. So we're not getting any better. Right, because we will be equating this thing to this thing, and that's the exact same formula I had before. So either we find a motivation to take a different kind of splitting, which we haven't found, or we're not going anywhere. So let's go to the second question. Is there anything wrong with the way we're choosing this region? And thinking about that, we found papers like this from the Journal of Sociology, American Journal of Sociology. Why do your friends have more friends than you do? You think about it, this is true for most of us. People who have a lot of friends are much more likely to be friends with you than people who have very few friends, right? So if you look at the average of friends among all your friends, it's going to be higher than your number of friends. Is this happening here? Actually, bigger cells have a larger probability that be reached before by your expanding region. Is this affecting our thing? And actually, we can also take a look at this other, the anatomy of the Facebook social graph paper. And they have this beautiful graph there, which basically this dotted curve is the number of friends your friends will have on average if they had the same number of friends as you do, whereas this is the actual data. So unless you have more than 800 friends on Facebook, the average of your friends is higher than your number of friends. We need to fix this problem if we want this thing to work. So a different thing that we can do that we proposed is, since we have three valent vertices, we can use the graph and the neighborhood vertices instead of the neighborhood cells. And in that case, everything should be fine because we don't have that problem anymore, but still we have an open question. Like giving a certain subgraph like that, how we determine which cells are inside and which cells are outside. We can either choose that only the cells that are completely surrounded by this subgraph are going to be considered, or every cell that touches at least one vertex is going to be considered, or something in between, like only cells that which half of its vertices are inside the selected graph. Like, there's still some freedom. And that should affect the result, because here we still have the same problem that we had. Larger cells have a bigger chance to be reached, but here is the opposite. Here, a bigger cell is more difficult to completely surround. So we did that, and we actually find that for the intermediate case, we still have negative curvatures all the way. If we take only the cells that are completely surrounded, we have positive curvatures. But it's not any better, because still it doesn't stabilize for any value. Keeps changing as we expand the region. Like, everything's a big mess. So yeah, we even tried to do one desperate attempt here, just like picking out random cells from the whole sphere and computing how the thing goes. And it seems to stabilize here close to a value of curvature 2, which is the right one, around like half the number of, half the total number of cells till the end. But this is for 1,000 cells. We did the same for 500,000 cells. And you get the exact same, only at half the number, the total number, the thing seems to stabilize. But now, if we look at the scale here, fluctuations are much, much larger. So it's worse. The more points I draw in, the worse it gets. So what is really going on here? Well, what really is going on here is that if we define this quantity L0, that is basically, so assume that the total number of edges that I have is the number of faces times the average number of faces divided by 2. This is like 6 plus something. So this is kind of like the extra edges or deficit of edges that I have respect to an average of 6. If I compute that, this is 6, like that. There is no dependence on the number of cells I'm throwing in. So the more seeds I put in, the thing I'm trying to measure, which is the difference between this, difference between this average and 6, which is what is going to give me the curvature, goes like 1 over the number of cells, of seeds. And the dispersion goes like 1 over the square root. So basically, my relative error is increasing with square root of the number of seeds as I add more seeds. So yeah, this thing doesn't seem to work. So the conclusion basically is that this proposal by von Belicherici and Winkler is a very, it raises a very interesting question, and it's a very interesting first step. Seems to be consistent for a conceptual point of view, but after all, when you try to apply it to real computations, this idea of applying global topological ideas to local computation doesn't seem to be any useful. So we need to keep working on this and keep working on extending this thing to 3D. So yeah, the main conclusions I want to see is basically, yeah, this is an interesting problem. It should arise in when one tries to look at the transition between discrete to continuous, but one doesn't have to be naive and realize that there are some issues that might arise that we didn't expect. In particular, these, like, how you choose a certain region can completely affect the measurements you're getting, and so it's worth pointing out that these issues are there, and whenever we address these kind of problems, we have to be aware of them. And that's what I wanted to say. Thank you.
Yeah, so I think that these problems, or the major problems, have been considered in actually calculus or other approaches. So basically, what it seems what we are trying to do here in very microscopic definition of the curvature. And then you don't change your definition with the curvature with the scale. So if you think of taking even considering the curvature square, which is always positive, and applying that to very to a large geometry in Bechet or whatever, you will always find a wrong result microscopically because you take all this fluctuation positively. So in this case, you have to actually kind of, it's not really real renormalization, but you have to kind of denormalize.
So when you say scale, you mean the coarse graining? Or
change the definition of the curvature or the curvature square to get something useful. So it's probably you read that, probably the notion of the staircase problem, you know, how to define the length of the curve.
Yeah, that is actually an interesting comment and something that we were trying to take a look at. Here, all I've done is just try to check the work by them. So I'm not adding anything
so
really new.
One idea might be basically to change how you measure certain geometric observables on larger scale if you take all the microscopic fluctuations.
We were also planning not to look farther than the first order and check if the standard dispersion can tell us some additional information and see also how the thing evolves as we keep expanding the region. There might be some additional information on that. Like, this is the most simple, naive approach.
Yeah. So maybe if you check, there's some literature on how R squared is defined in ratchet calculus or even dynamical triangulation.
No, I just wanted to mention that in the 80s, there was a lot of work on trying to do lattice Yang-Mills theory on these polynomial problems. PDE, something like
PDE.
Yeah, so if you didn't, no.
This is very clean and it's very good that this was done. I think it clarifies the point. But is that the right way of thinking? I mean, in fact, you seem to be confirming doubts, strong doubts about this way of thinking. Because, look, imagine that I have a radio wave, electromagnetic field. So I have a macroscopic electromagnetic field that I can write E and B as cosine of the wave, and I go up. And then Melli and company come and say, well, actually, the reality is Fock space of photons. So let's see if I can recover the electromagnetic field by sprinkling photons up and down in such a way. That's clearly the wrong way of thinking about that, right? We have quantum theory with a certain number of quanta, which give us this big picture. We have a classical theory with the field. There's no difference whatsoever, conceptually, between the problem of recovering the electromagnetic field from Fock space and the problem of recovering a flat space or a curved space, a smooth space from quanta of gravity. It's the same problem. Namely, if you take a random state in Fock space, it's as far as possible from an electromagnetic field. This doesn't prevent us from working with antennas and engineering and thinking about even its kinematic discovery. So it seems to me that the point of view of just focusing on these microscopic things and imagining that there should be some magic thing that constructs smoothing is just the wrong way. You just have to do what we do in electromagnetism and understand why there we can think in terms of macroscopic fields. And then we understand, I mean, there's a quantum theory with quantum, a classical limit. So I always have been confused by it. This is not a criticism of what you've done. You've done it perfect. I mean, so while seeing what specifically not,
yeah, well,
not working.
What I could answer is that the reason why I am interested in this problem basically is it's because you could put it as a more fundamental thing if you want, just like from the mathematical point of view, does the abstract structure of a graph and restrict you in some way about what are the possible continuous, the possible geometries in which you can embed it. And that is a very broad question, and it's very hard to answer, but it might be interesting if
yes,
there's something you can get out of it.
It might also be that it has nothing to do with the problem of how continuous space is.
It might be.
See, the mathematical problem of how a random state in Fock space has anything to do with a continuous electromagnetic wave, it's not related to the classical limit of QCP or mathematics.
Quick one. It is a quick one. It's just a follow-up to what Carlos says. It's very similar to saying you want to build the Schwarzschild black hole out of gravitons, and you can't do it. Although some people claim you can.
All right, well, let's thank you.
Do we have our remotes? Yeah. Yes, thank you. Thank you very much. So I'm Valerio Astuti from La Sapienza University of Rome, and I will talk about a particular approach to non-commutative spacetimes, and in particular of the consequences of this approach to the Snyder spacetime. The talk is based on a collaboration with Giovanni Amerino Camelia, and I would like to thank the Institute for having me as a guest for the last few months. The talk is divided in three parts. I will give a brief introduction on non-commutative spacetimes in general, and then introduce the main ingredient of this approach, that is a covariant formulation of quantum mechanics introduced by Heisenberg and Rovelli. And this formulation of quantum mechanics is plentiful of advantages for the treatments of the non-commutative spacetimes. And in particular, it will have surprising consequences for the case of Snyder spacetime. So what is a non-commutative spacetime? It's a deformation of the commutation relations between coordinates, and they were introduced as a solution for the divergence in the field theories to create a physical cutoff for the field theories. But after the renormalization techniques, they are used more in the, some parts of the quantum gravity sectors, because they are thought to implement quantum properties of spacetime as an effective theory of some more fundamental quantum theory of gravity. And usually, non-commutative spacetimes are implemented in field theories, but here we will try to give a treatment of them for a theory of a single particle. In particular, for the Snyder spacetime, we have this kind of commutation relations between coordinates. It is the first proposed non-commutative spacetime, and it has the peculiarity of being to preserve the Lorentz invariance, whereas usually when there is a deformation of the commutation relations between coordinates, there is also a deformation of the symmetry group. Here, there is we have Lorentz invariance, but the space sector of this spacetime is a quantum lattice. We will see that the representation of these coordinates will have a discrete spectrum. The discrete spectrum derived from the fact that the rotations, generators, and coordinates rescaled with the deformation parameter L forms an SO4 subalgebra that can be decomposed in two products of SU2 algebras with the same Casimirs. So the representation will be labeled by the standard eigenvalues of the angular momentum theory, representation theory. For example, we can diagonalize one coordinate and obtain this kind of spectrum for it. So we will have a one-dimensional lattice with lattice spacing L, the deformation parameter, that will be linked to the Planck length for our interest. Now, the main problem of non-commutative spacetimes, in my point of view, is an interpretation one, because we have that when the deformation parameters goes to zero, we should recover some known theory of commuting coordinate observables. But we don't have any, we are not used to any theory in which coordinates are commuting observables, because time is always treated as a parameter. I mean, it's in standard quantum mechanics, we have the space observables, but the time is just a parameter. So to solve this problem, I will use a covariant formulation of quantum mechanics that is based on an Hilbert space of integrable function of the whole space-time. So we have this kind of Hilbert space. We have canonical commutation relations between space-time coordinates and space-time momenta. And it is important to stress that we don't have any on-shellness relations. So the momenta are free variables. They are not linked between each other. The states in this Hilbert space will describe probabilities of finding particles in space-time regions, so in space region and at a given time interval. And being symmetric with respect to time and space will provide a good environment to implement the non-trivial commutation relations between coordinates. But we have to stress that here, in this Hilbert space, we don't have any dynamic, because it's just a description of space-time, so we don't have any description of particle behavior here. To implement particle dynamics, we have to impose a constraint on this kinematical Hilbert space in a similar way as we do for constrained classical mechanics. And usually the constraint is the Casimir of the symmetry algebra we choose for the kinematical space. For example, we can reproduce the usual Galilean quantum mechanics or the relativistic quantum mechanics of a single particle choosing these two constraints. This one is corresponding to the Galilean symmetry group, and this one to the standard Lorentz Poincaré group. And so I will say it again, we can reproduce the usual theory of quantum mechanics that is on quantum mechanics book by choosing a constraint from this symmetric kinematical Hilbert space. And to implement the constraint, we have to consider a new Hilbert space, that is the space of equivalence classes of states with respect to the care of this operator. So we will modify the scalar product, and we emphasize that now the physical operators, the observables relative to particles, are the self-adjoint operators on this new Hilbert space, the physical Hilbert space. So they are self-adjoint with respect to this scalar product. And in particular, if we have a particular combination of kinematic observables, for it to be a physical observable, it has to commute with the constraint. So for the standard Galilean quantum mechanics, for example, when we consider the space coordinate, the standard X coordinate, it is not the, the space coordinate in the kinematical Hilbert space, but is this combination where here Q are the coordinates in the kinematical space. Taking this combination of kinematical observables, we have a physical position observable. So the X coordinate we are used to, that we used to see on the quantum mechanics books, is this X here, is not a coordinate in the kinematical Hilbert space. And the same can be said about the Newton-Wigner operator, that is the corresponding position operator for relativistic theories, or for this general class of operators that were introduced by Friedel, Girelli, and Levine, and that contain the Newton-Wigner operator for a particular choice of this vector Bu. To represent the Snyder coordinates, we have this choice of this function on the kinematical Hilbert space. Snyder himself provided us with this representation. But usually people try to describe particle behavior with considering this coordinate as the physical coordinates associated with particles. But these coordinates live on the kinematical Hilbert space, so we cannot describe the dynamics with them. We have to implement the constraint and go to the physical Hilbert space. Here it's useful to remember that the Snyder spacetime is a Lorentz invariant. So we will have the same symmetry group we have for the standard Minkowski space. And so the same Casimir of the symmetry algebra. So the constraint, the Hamiltonian constraint will be the same. And considering the standard Newton-Wigner operator or this family of operators, just substituting the Snyder coordinate with the previous Q1, we will have good physical operators because the constraint will be the same, the functional form of these coordinates will be the same, so they will commute with the constraint. And now we can study the spectra of these coordinates that will be physical coordinates associated to particles. Obtaining a surprising result in that the symmetry of the deformation in the space and time coordinates allow us to derive that the deformation, the L correction to the coordinates drop out from these physical expressions. So we will have that this general physical coordinate is undeformed. We will not have any L correction in it. And this is not just a peculiarity of in the choice of the representation of coordinates or the choice of these particular functions, in that any function of the kinematical free space to commute with the constraint can have a functional dependence from the space-time variables only through the generators of the Lorentz group. So we will have this kind of function, only this kind of function can be physical, can commute with the Hamiltonian constraint. So it's easy to derive that if we don't have any deformation of the Lorentz group, we cannot have any deformation for space-time functions in such spaces, in the Snyder space-time and in any space that doesn't have any deformation of the symmetry group. So this is the main result of this approach, the triviality of the Snyder space-time coordinate functions. And we can draw this set of conclusions that representation of non-commutative spacetimes are usually given in the kinematical Hilbert space, but people try to treat particle behavior on it, on the kinematical space, without considering that we should go to the physical space and consider physical observables commuting with the constraint. So with this, having in mind this idea and approaching the Snyder spacetime, we see that without the formation of the Lorentz group, we have trivial spacetime sector. We have that the spectra of the physical coordinate is no more discrete, but is a continuum undeformed spectrum, even if the kinematical operator spectra are deformed, are discrete. And so in general, we can derive that the discreteness of a spacetime observable in the kinematical Hilbert space does not imply any discreteness in the physical sector. So to derive physical consequences related to particles, we have to consider physical observables instead of the kinematical ones. So that's it, and there are some references, and thank you for the attention.
Any questions?
I thought it very clear, but at the end, your conclusions, what do they mean? Can you elaborate a moment about
All of them? Or?
Well, yeah.
For, well, in general, for the...
Yeah, somehow I got to the physics, to the mathematics. Physics, what is triviality?
For the general approach to non-commutative space-time, I think that we should derive the general rule of considering the duality between the kinematical space and the physical Hilbert space.
Yeah.
Usually, the treatment of the theories are just on one space, that is the...
This is clear, yeah.
So, okay, we should treat the both spaces. For the Snyder spacetime in particular, we can derive from this approach that the Snyder spacetime is not discrete. Usually, it's said to be discrete because...
So this is the main conclusion.
Yeah, for the Snyder spacetime, yeah.
Seriously, then the discreteness is not there.
Yeah, exactly. When we consider a particle on Snyder spacetime, we don't have any discrete spectrum because the physical coordinates are on the form, they are trivial.
Is this reappearing in some other way or not really?
Maybe with an interacting field theory, they could appear, yeah. Because for a single particle theory, no, and for a free field theory, they cannot appear. For an interacting
for
one,
field theory, it's just like Minkowski space.
Yeah, it seems so. Because, well, it seems so at least. And in general, yeah, this last conclusion is even more general, and it's that it's risky to conclude from kinematical observable discreteness that the physics will be discrete because we should consider physical observables, not kinematical ones.
But this depends on the choice of time you take, because if you deal with a non-deformed case, a normal case,
yeah,
you choose the clock and your coordinates are going to become non-commutative. If you choose a given some clock, that depends on momentum.
You are talking of the particular this particular choice of coordinates, right?
That's right. So here, I guess in the Snyder case, you can maybe choose a clock such that the non-commutativity goes away. But if you are choosing another clock, there will be...
No, but a clock will give a physical result, right? I mean, the reading of the clock are physical numbers, right? So they will be observables on the physical space. And in general...
No, but if you calculate the Dirac, so you're choosing a clock means doing a gauge fixing.
Yeah.
So you have to calculate the Dirac bracket.
Yeah.
And the other packets don't have to be, in general, if you take whatever clock you want, so they don't have to be commutative. Just like in the normal case, when you commute with the Minkowski space time, you can choose some clocks. You calculate the Dirac bracket of your coordinates, your observables, and then going to be non commutative in general.
I'm not sure if I understand the point, actually.
If you look at the observables we are dealing with, Eteran and Laurent. They're going to get non-trivial.
No, that's the point. These one are not deformed here. If we substitute the Snyder representation of coordinates, the deformation cancels between the...
Because you're already in the Snyder. But if you are doing Minkowski, if you are just doing normal...
In Minkowski,
that's
right.
That you can have something which is
low Mars, the normal stuff, and make it non-commutative.
Yeah, 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 that's right.
And here you're choosing something non-commutative at the beginning, mm-hmm. and by a clever choice, you're killing the non-commutativity piece just because you made a clever choice.
No, my point is that it's not a choice. The deviation of this work is that any physical observable has to be independent from the deformation parameter because of this last slide. If you choose a physical function, the dependence from space-time coordinates cannot be general, can be only of this form, can be expressed only by the Lorentz generators. And if the symmetry group is not deformed, like in the Snyder case, we cannot have any deformation of this function, right? So it's pretty general.
But what happens in the computation relation between X and P? Because the standard is also modified. So do you get some, like...
The canonical relation between... between...
changed, then definitely there's some
Yeah, but they are kinematical. I mean, the canonical commutation relations are observables in the kinematical space.
So, if you calculate, if you go to the dynamical space, the commutation relations are not changed.
Yeah, they're not changed. Any observable in the physical space.
But, and X and X, I understand that maybe you can cancel that out, but you shouldn't be able to cancel both.
Excuse me? I mean, the P, the momenta are not deformed, right?
Yeah, but X and P has, kinematically, they increases. Fantastically as momentum drops.
Yeah. But the fact is that if you take here, you should consider the canonical commutation relation between this operator and the momentum, right? So even if the.
So it's going to be for energy, right? AI is going to not commute with.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's new. That's the form.
No, it's not the form. Why?
Oh, okay. That's,
okay, maybe we can discuss later.
Great. Well, thanks to the organizers for this opportunity, and thank you for those who remain. Your endurance is very impressive, so I thank you. So what I'm going to do is tell you a little bit about some classical work and some work on the quantization of plane gravitational waves. And really the content of this talk, however, is really the motivation of this project. So let me get started on that. In the real connection formulation, loop quantum gravity has discrete geometric observables, such as, geometric quantities, such as area and angle. And this discrete spectrum, if it's physically correct, will have observable manifestation. Now, what that observable manifestation is, we don't know, okay? And so some years ago, Alfaro et al. Did some work where they introduce a semi-classical state, actually introducing a length scale, so I'll come back to that moment, and then looked at the expectation value of the Hamiltonian for Maxwell theory and other theories as well to derive what happens. They found that the dispersion relations of the theory were modified, and that, for me anyway, launched a bit of work which then connected directly with experiments. So this is a case where we were actually able to do some great stuff. And for those of you who aren't familiar with it, in the context of effective field theory, you can, if you have modified dispersion relations and thus break Lorentz invariance, you can actually constrain the effects to the point that they're ruled out. So the lowest order effects are ruled out. Even the next order have strong constraints now due to work that's not due to me, but folks who've worked on this more recently. So it's very, very effective. If you do something dramatic to the theory, like particle theory, you can really constrain it dramatically. Now, that length scale they introduced in semi-classical state to do the expansion was where the Lorentz violation occurred, and so it's very clear where that happened. But what I would like to do is to derive from something like this, loop quantum gravity and these discrete geometry, what observational effects would be there. Now, in the full case, that's hard, and perhaps too hard at the moment. So what we'd like to do is come up with a model where we can actually go work through the quantization and then look at the possible effects. Specifically, as I said, what are the effects? Perhaps not modified dispersion relations, perhaps something else. And then specifically, which steps in the quantization, this is our hope, will yield those observational steps so we can actually pinpoint the connection to observable effects in the choices or the methods that we do in quantization. Okay, so what we're looking for is a model which we might be able to quantize and then which we might be able to look at just the effects of discrete geometry on propagation of modes, okay? So here's one possibility, and that is a system of, it's an exact solution, it's plane gravitational waves, as it turns out also it'll carry over to the Einstein-Maxwell case, but I will say no more about that for the moment. So let me just look at this metric. It's very, very simple. What we're looking at is, again, propagating waves in one direction, and they're planar waves, so we have a symmetry reduction that's rather dramatic. And what we have in this metric is this L, which is a background factor, the geometry reacts, to the wave factor, this beta, and beta is actually a free function. Einstein's equations, which are simply this, show the reaction of L to respect to this free function beta. And for the consistency with the symmetry reduction, L and beta are either functions of U or V, the light cone coordinates. Okay. So, and the Einstein's equations become quite simple, that L just evolves according to a time-dependent angular frequency. Okay, so the idea is to try to look at a quantization of this in the context of loop quantum gravity. And so what we've done so far is look at just setting up the model classically first in a couple of papers. The first one here, what we did is we introduced a constraint, which was not Diffeo invariant, and that enforced a single direction of propagation. Of course, if you had colliding waves, then they would want to collapse, which would break. Which would conflict with the symmetry assumptions of the model. So we have to have just one direction, unidirectional waves. And nonetheless, we were able to push this a little further, and we got non-local Dirac brackets, and that's a bit of a mess for quantization, but it would suggest no dispersion, but modifications of the fundamental length, h bar, g, something like that. Okay. But to access these techniques, what we really want is a first-class system, and we were able to do that. I'll describe that in this talk, and then also, there's work in progress, which I'll also describe a bit on the quantization. Okay. So after doing symmetry reduction, we get this metric for space-time. We have a phase space, which are sort of triad-like variables and connection variables, familiar from many talks this week. It's eight-dimensional. They have usual Poisson brackets and so forth. And we have essentially just the sort of xy. The xy are the plane of the planar symmetry of the wave, and then z is the direction the wave propagates in. And so well, we have this system. This is really a continuation of earlier work. And I'll just mention that K is directly proportional to the usual connection. Okay. All right. Okay, so we get constraints. These constraints are obviously more simple because of the symmetry direction. We have good old Gauss, just a U1 in that transverse plane. We have the residual Diffeo that is in the Z. We have a Hamiltonian constraint. Don't worry, it's not perhaps so bad at this point. And we have this right moving constraint. And now this turns out to be an all first class system. We have the usual algebra for GR, the standard one that you know and love if you do canonical work. And then this first class algebra here continues with this left or right. It doesn't matter, but I chose the one of them, the right moving constraint. We get a first class algebra. Now, so we still have this nice algebra, so we can do loop quantum gravity techniques, but it still has these structure functions, so it expects some complication, perhaps considerable complication later. Okay. Let me remind you, it's an exact solution, and it's also one where we do have local degrees of freedom along the z direction, so it's not a quantum mechanics. Okay. So just a little note on something I'll say in a bit. If you want a no wave state, so the state around which you'll probably want to perturb, produce waves, what you can do is combine the right moving and left moving constraints and impose both of them. That's equivalently this combination, which I'll call K, and then constant in along the z direction for this z tribe. So there's two ways to interpret this. One is that you can say that the cross-sectional area is constant in time. That's the same form of that K constraint there. Or you can equivalently say that the momentum conjugate to length, which I'll write down in a moment, is constant. Or, sorry, it's vanishing. Okay. So as far as the quantization, the kinematics is completely straightforward. You have a one-dimensional spin network. You put on holonomies along these edges. Then you have point holonomies that are really the sort of X and Y holonomies. You have a triplet of quantum numbers. And geometric quantities are easy enough to do. You have length, so length along the z direction. You have volume. These K labels could be different, but I'll also talk about situations in where they're all constant, as was suggested by the previous slide. And so all that just goes through really quite easily. Good. So looking at the flat space case now, you want to impose this constraint. You can directly quantize it, but there's the you get divergent expectation values of length, even for the smallest possible interval, so yuck. Instead, what we did is temper that by multiplying by the volume operator, just another form of it. That's the form we use just to get a Hermitian form. And you can get explicit solutions, and all is well. So you can get this, or all is apparently well, for this no-wave state around which you might perturb to get an actual wave. However, you will want to see if this is actually a physical state. So what we do is we consult the Tiemann Hamiltonian. We work on it. We reformulate it in the appropriate way classically. We quantize it, and we do this. And we get this result. You're supposed to groan loudly at this point. So we get this. But nonetheless, this is something we can work with. And so I'll just tell you the results for this. So suppose we take a superposition of states. V here just represents the mu nu and k for every vertex and edge. And then we impose this constraint, and so we get these two results. So first of all, we don't have any normalizable non-degenerate solutions where we restrict those coefficients to be non-vanishing only on a block of space of in mu nu and k, so that you have to extend them out. That looks a little, so that's not easy to do. And then furthermore, this the state that I derived earlier for the no-wave state, where all the k values were constant, is also not part of the physical Hilbert space. Okay, so, oh well, that doesn't quite work. These are preliminary results, and we will continue. Let me just summarize here. So what we've done so far is a classical analysis. We've done the quantization kinematics is quite straightforward. We've done initial investigation of the quantum constraints. I didn't mention this in detail, so let me do that now, so that we have some understanding of the flat space constraints in terms of those geometric quantities. So maybe it makes sense that that state isn't a physical state, because what we're demanding is that the cross-sectional area doesn't change at all, and also the length, the momentum conjugate to length is just zero, so that quantum mechanically, it's similar to imposing a similar constraint in quantum mechanics, say p equals zero and so on. Okay, so obviously there's further work to do to get the physical states and then investigate the algebra, characterize the physical state space. But really, our actual goal is in the end look at propagation of these gravitational waves and then possible dispersion relations or other effects. Thank you.
Question. So you're doing kind of the analog of what they do in loop cosmology, except that there are more fibers.
Yes.
They have one. We have
three once we solve the Gauss constraint, which is easy to do. We have three. But it's really loop quantum, because it's literally Chuk loop quantum cosmologies plus this additional thing, which will be, you can compare to the spherically symmetric case, the radial case. And so it's really closest to the spherically symmetric case, but it's similar to both, yeah. And then when we do this, we are using all the SU2 methods from the full theory, just to try them out.
And so the outcome should be the gravity?
Yes.
And so you recover the polarization, you would
Yes. Yeah. That's right.
Mm-hmm. All right. So what would be the strategy to read up from which would you read off this modified dispersion relation?
An excellent, yes, an excellent question. So we haven't done it yet. Here's the expectation. We need to find the asymptotic states, right? So it'll be some wave, and then that wave will cause the background to change. But what we will need is these asymptotic states, and then we will, from there, use the time and so forth on those, on that asymptotic space-time to then time, literally, the propagation of this wave through and see, according to those variables, whether there's any dispersion. I mean, that's the plan. But it's not done yet, but to use the asymptotics.